Sin City Stories contains explicit content that may be disturbing to some listeners, including strong language, graphic details, and depictions of violent crimes. Listener discretion is advised. Thousands of bombs have gone off across the United States over the course of the 20th and 21st centuries for every reason, from the personal to the political to the financial. And through its short history, the city of Las Vegas has not been spared from the threat of criminal bombings. Since its founding on May 15, 1905, Las Vegas has gone from being a small railway stop in the middle of the Mojave Desert to a glittering neon oasis of gambling, shopping, fine dining, and entertainment, welcoming tens of millions of visitors from around the world every year. Through its relatively short history, the city has been witness to over a century's worth of murder, robberies, arson, and mayhem. And that's what we're here to share with you. In collaboration with mayheminthedesert.com, this is Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, the sordid tales behind the stranger-than-fiction history of fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. During the early morning hours of March 8, 1972, a Boeing 707 airliner sat parked at passenger gate 10 of McCarran International Airport, just a short distance from the world-famous Las Vegas Strip. At approximately 3:50 a.m., an explosion thundered through the cockpit of the plane, hurling debris and twisted metal across the tarmac from the starboard side of the aircraft. A small fire erupted before burning itself out, but there were no injuries as a result of the blast due to the early hour of the attack. Within a short time of the blast, the plane was moved as far as possible from public view to avoid disturbing airline passengers. The previous day, an anonymous caller had phoned in a threat to TWA headquarters. Their plan? Over a six-hour time span, they intended to bomb one TWA plane every hour, unless the company paid them a $2 million ransom. One bomb was discovered on March 7, 1972, in an attaché case aboard a TWA plane at JFK Airport in New York City. The bomb was found only minutes before the device could detonate. Investigators believe the bomb that went off at McCarran Airport had been placed on the plane in New York City, and that it had been missed when the aircraft was screened before departing for Vegas. Police had been monitoring TWA aircraft departing from and arriving to McCarran since the extortion threats came in, and they had set up a security perimeter around the airport. TWA refused to publicly comment on reports that company executives were negotiating with the extortionists. Federal agents from various agencies worked across the country to identify any further potential bomb threats to passenger aircraft, and the general manager of TWA in Las Vegas noted the culprit was someone likely to know his way around the industry and would have to know a considerable amount about the aircraft. Following the bombing, security measures were tightened at McCarran Airport, including building a fence around the entire perimeter of the airfield. Prior to the 1972 bombing, it was possible to drive right up to the tarmac from the roads surrounding McCarran. McCarran Airport also began issuing identification cards for employees and prohibiting anyone but passengers from entering gate areas. No suspects were ever arrested or charged for the bombing in Vegas or the attempted bombing in New York. In the early morning hours of January 7, 1967, Glitter Gulch, the unofficial name of the casino district in downtown Las Vegas, was still bustling with the weekend influx of tourists. Those gathered around the table games on the casino floor of the El Cortez were downing drinks and deciding whether to hit or stay when at exactly 1:25 a.m., the ground shook violently beneath their feet. A second later, they were plunged into darkness. A few moments passed before the lights flickered back to life, the guests and dealers exchanging confused looks with each other. As curious patrons filtered out of the El Cortez onto Fremont Street, they encountered a scene that would have been more expected thousands of miles away in the cities of South Vietnam, rather than in the center of the undisputed gambling capital of the United States. Shards of glass littered the street outside the El Cortez as the explosion had shattered windows for several blocks, and a plume of grayish-black smoke was rising from the site of the Orbit Inn, one of the two- and three-story motels lining the east side of Fremont Street. An enormous gash had been torn into the facade of the structure, and soon people began walking in a stunned daze from the rubble of the shattered building. The force of the blast ripped through flesh and bone, scattering body parts into the streets and alleyways surrounding the Orbit Inn. First responders worked through the night, performing the gruesome task of collecting the remains of the victims into black body bags and arranging them on the sidewalk. Police ultimately recovered six bodies from the wreckage of the motel, with a dozen more people treated for injuries. The explosion at the Orbit Inn would turn out to be the deadliest bombing in the history of Las Vegas. Surprisingly, in a city famous for mafia-linked bombings, this murderous act was carried out by a deserter from the U.S. Army for reasons that still remain shrouded in mystery. It didn't take long for investigators to figure out that the blast originated in room 214, which was registered to Richard J. Paris and his wife Christine. And due to the nature of the damage caused by the explosion, the police were able to determine the blast at the Orbit Inn was caused by a perpetrator employing high explosives. Richard James Paris was born in 1938 in Illinois to young parents. Paris enlisted in the military at the age of 17, and accounts indicate he enjoyed his time in the service. But at some point, Paris's behavior caused him to be written up for violations of the Army's code of conduct. The anger and embarrassment over this official reprimand caused Paris to go AWOL for the first time. He was on the lam for several months before deciding he wanted to return to the only career he'd ever known. Paris threw himself on the mercy of the military, writing to several generals with a plea to be reinstated to his former position. Paris was convincing, and upon his reinstatement with the Army, he was assigned to a position as a shipping clerk at Fort Ord in California. While stationed at Fort Ord, Paris met Christine Swigum, a woman about 5 years his junior who had emigrated to the United States with her family from Australia when she was a child. Paris and Christine were eventually wed, and the marriage at least gave the outward appearance of being a happy one. Things went fine for a period of time until Paris again ran into troubles with his superiors in the Army. It's unknown what he was disciplined for, but in November of 1966, Richard Paris again failed to show up for duty and went AWOL. The couple settled briefly in Hollywood, California, and then seemed to have traveled around the country over the next 2 months. Shortly before landing in Las Vegas in early 1967, Richard Paris made a trip to Phoenix, Arizona, where he legally purchased several pounds of dynamite and obtained a permit to transport the explosives. Shortly after Christine returned to room 214, a little before 1:30 a.m., a thunderous blast ripped through the Orbit Inn. The theories behind why 28-year-old Richard Paris detonated over 20 pounds of dynamite in downtown Vegas began before all of the victims had even been identified. Some investigators guessed the bombing may have been the result of a lover's quarrel. Meanwhile, the Clark County District Attorney openly admitted he just wanted to put out any theory that wasn't mob-related in order to limit negative publicity for the city. The evidence gathered from the bombing scene was eventually forwarded to the FBI. It was felt that the federal agency would have a greater ability to synthesize Paris's movements around the country, thus possibly drawing a conclusion on the cause of the blast. FBI investigators returned a verdict that Paris intentionally detonated the dynamite he purchased in Arizona because the AWOL soldier was bent on suicide because of his troubles in the service. Regardless of the motives behind the bombing, Richard and Christine Paris lie side by side today at the Rose Hills Memorial Park in Los Angeles, with matching inscriptions on their tombstones reading, "Our sunshine and happiness." On a scorching 115-degree summer afternoon, on July 25, 1972, a former FBI agent, ex-president of the State Bar of Nevada, two-term member of the Nevada Assembly, and prominent local Las Vegas attorney left his law office at a 10-story downtown office building. Bill Coulthard made his way to the parking garage located on the third floor. The attorney climbed into his vehicle and cracked the windows before inserting his key in the ignition. An explosion thundered throughout downtown Vegas. Four sticks of dynamite hidden near the steering column of Coulthard's car detonated with the turn of his key, transforming the vehicle into a twisted hulk of scorched metal and setting several other nearby vehicles on fire. Casino magnate Benny Binion, who was suspected of murdering the wife of a rival back in Dallas with a car bomb, listened to the explosion from his office in the downtown Horseshoe Casino, just two blocks away from the bomb site. He knew that all of his hard work in Las Vegas wouldn't be for naught and that his legacy would be protected. Benny Binion moved to Vegas in 1946, bringing along two suitcases loaded with cash earned from the decades that he operated illegal gambling rackets throughout Dallas. Over the years, Benny Binion had built a national reputation founded upon his downtown Las Vegas Horseshoe Casino. But Binion didn't own the land on which he built his empire. He leased it, and his principal landlord was none other than Bill Coulthard, who controlled a 37.5% interest in the property on which Binion's Horseshoe Casino was situated. Binion's lease was set to expire in the early 1970s, and the straight-laced former FBI agent Coulthard was not in the mood to renew the lease of a vicious gangster who had already developed a reputation around Las Vegas for using violence to settle disputes. Binion engaged in furious negotiations in an effort to get Coulthard to come around, but as one of Binion's associates would later say of the efforts, "He tried to negotiate with the asshole, but the son of a bitch wouldn't budge." In the end, Coulthard decided to lease the land to new tenants, one with less questionable backgrounds than Binion. But Binion was not about to let the multi-million dollar enterprise he'd built from scratch go without a fight. When Benny Binion needed a dirty job done, he had one man who he knew he could turn to. Tom Hanley was the man Benny Binion relied upon to solve problems via less than legal methods. And since the mid-60s, Tom Hanley had worked with his son, Gramby Hanley, to carry out at least six murders, as well as over a dozen bombings, arsons, and several burglaries throughout Las Vegas. Sometime in 1972, Benny Binion determined there was only one way to save the Horseshoe Casino, and he allegedly paid Tom Hanley a hefty sum to eliminate a problem. The daylight execution of Bill Coulthard rocked Las Vegas. The power brokers of the city knew and liked Bill Coulthard, and they demanded action in response to the brutal slaying. The ability to solve the crime would prove that law and order still existed in a town that had made a habit of turning a blind eye to the activities of its less than savory characters. Beecher Zavants, the homicide detective working the case, diligently tracked down leads and within a few months determined that the most likely suspect had been Tom Hanley and that the most likely motive was Binion's desire to maintain control of his casino. But Detective Zavants ran into an insurmountable roadblock. His boss, Clark County Sheriff Ralph Lamb, was a close personal friend and business associate of Benny Binion. In fact, years later, Sheriff Lamb would face a federal investigation in relation to tens of thousands of dollars in loans that Binion had given the county's top cop. Benny Binion was questioned by police in relation to the bombing, but denied any responsibility, and the case ultimately went cold. As for Binion's Horseshoe Casino, after Coulthard's death, the control of his shares fell to his deceased wife's brothers, who signed a 100-year lease with Benny Binion.
Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.
It was early morning, May 7th, 2007, just after 4 a.m. 27-year-old Willibaldo Durantes Antonio had just clocked out from his job at Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs in the food court of the Egyptian-themed Luxor Hotel and Casino on the south end of the Vegas Strip. Accompanying him was his new girlfriend, Karen Challey, who also worked at the Luxor. The couple made their way to the top of the two-story parking garage behind the Luxor, where Durantes Antonio had parked his car. As he approached, he noticed a coffee cup placed on top of his vehicle. Durantes Antonio lifted the 24-ounce 7-Eleven Styrofoam coffee cup from the roof. An explosion ripped through the night air. But what Durantes Antonio didn't know, and would have no reason to have suspected, was that within the coffee cup was a motion-activated pipe bomb. The explosive device fatally wounded Durantes Antonio and sent shrapnel throughout the top floor of the garage, with the jagged metal piercing other nearby vehicles. Miraculously, Karen Challey was uninjured by the bomb despite being only feet from the blast. This was only a few years after 9/11, and national news media immediately speculated that the bombing was the result of a terrorist attack. But within hours, detectives from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department determined that the murder of Durantes Antonio was not the result of an international terrorist cell or organized crime. Instead, it stemmed from what local news media dubbed a jilted lover seeking revenge. Police determined that the bomb planted in the Luxor parking garage had been the work of Omar Rueda Denvers, Karen Challey's ex-boyfriend and the father of her daughter. Rueda Denvers sought the assistance of his friend, Porfirio Duarte Herrera, in seeking revenge against his ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend. Duarte Herrera allegedly had expert bomb-making skills and was believed to be responsible for a bombing at a Las Vegas-area Home Depot. Rueda Denvers had allegedly become obsessed with Challey after the couple's breakup, with Rueda Denvers stalking Challey for several months. On the night of the bombing, Rueda Denvers and Duarte Herrera waited at a gas station not far from the Luxor and listened for the blast. Following their arrests, a five-day trial resulted in the convictions of both Rueda Denvers and Duarte Herrera. Both men were sentenced to life in prison. Duarte Herrera made headlines again in 2022 when he briefly escaped from a Nevada prison before being recaptured. He was later transferred to a maximum security facility in Ely, Nevada. The Culinary Union local in Las Vegas developed into a powerhouse under the leadership of union organizer Al Bramlett. But despite its power, the Culinary Union was unable to bring several off-strip restaurants into its fold, even after decades of picketing. When conventional organizing methods proved unsuccessful, Bramlett resorted to less savory avenues. It was the night of December 20th, 1975. As over 300 patrons and 70 staff occupied the high-end Alpine Village Inn restaurant, two bombs tore through the roof of the building near the kitchen.
Despite the bombs causing a fire to break out, everyone inside the restaurant was able to escape without injury.
The lack of loss of life was miraculous. Investigators determined that one of the two bombs had nearly ruptured a gas line, which would have instantly reduced the entire building to rubble. Las Vegas did not have long to recover from this bombing. Less than a month later,
on January 12, 1976,
another explosion thundered through the pre-dawn air about a mile west of downtown Vegas. The target of this blast was David's Place, a gourmet restaurant that had long resisted efforts at unionization. Police investigators determined that the blast had been caused by high explosives left at the rear of the gutted restaurant. Things remained quiet for the next year. Then, on the night of January 24, 1977, the culprits behind the previous bombings engaged in a dangerous escalation. Security guards at two off-strip non-union restaurants,
the Village Pub and the Starboard Tack,
noticed pools of gasoline beneath Jeeps in each of the parking lots. emergency dispatchers received calls from each location just a few minutes apart. The local bomb squad determined that each Jeep contained 350 pounds of gasoline
rigged to explode upon someone opening the car door.
Fortunately, that never happened, and a disaster was averted. Tom and Gramby Hanley, a father-son hitman team whose handiwork had already left a bloody trail across Las Vegas, had been hired by Bramlett to place the bombs at non-union restaurants. The relationship between the Hanleys and Bramlett had run along smoothly
until the failed twin bombings at the Village Pub and Starboard Tack.
Things broke down when Bramlett refused to pay the hitmen the $10,000 he promised for the job. The Hanleys were not ones to be stiffed on money they felt was owed to them. But while the Hanleys wanted to settle their score with Bramlett, they also wanted to avoid unnecessary risks to their safety. After all, it was widely known that Bramlett always carried a .357 revolver on his person in case one of his many enemies tried to do him harm. So, in February of 1977, the Hanleys met Bramlett in the one place they knew he'd be unarmed.
As he exited a plane at Las Vegas's McCarran Airport.
Thanks to a recent spat of skyjackings, airport security had been tightened, which made getting a firearm on board an aircraft much more difficult. The Hanleys escorted the union boss from the terminal to the parking garage, forced Bramlett into a waiting vehicle, and then drove out to the desert. A few weeks later, a couple out on a hike several miles outside the city discovered Bramlett's body
buried under a pile of rocks.
Police determined that the union boss had been killed by a gunshot to the head, but Bramlett's killers hadn't left much in the way of clues, and the elements had already limited the amount of evidence to be gained from Bramlett's corpse. The police were at a dead end as far as suspects in the murder until they received an unlikely break. One of the four men who'd accompanied Bramlett on his fateful ride out to the desert came forward to reveal the identities of his cohorts.
Though the Hanleys skipped town after murdering Bramlett, they were eventually arrested for the killing.
The Hanleys ended up cutting a deal with federal prosecutors who had been investigating the leadership of the local 226, including their role in the restaurant bombings of 1975 through to 1977. In exchange for the Hanleys pleading guilty to the Bramlett murder, prosecutors agreed to allow the Hanleys to serve their sentences at a federal prison in San Diego rather than the Nevada State Prison in Carson City, where the hitmen feared for their lives. It was October 4th, 1982. Frank "Lefty" Rosenthal, the reputed frontman for organized crime outfits that ran the Stardust Casino for a period, climbed into his Oldsmobile in the parking lot outside the Tony Roma's on East Sahara Avenue. A moment after he turned his key in the ignition, an explosion tore through the rear of Rosenthal's car. Explosives placed on the undercarriage of the 53-year-old former gambler and casino executive's car had been triggered by the turn of the key. But while Rosenthal's would-be assassins knew his routine well enough to successfully plant the bomb, they were apparently ignorant of the fact that Rosenthal's Cadillac had a steel floor plate. While the blast was deflected away from the driver's seat, it did tear through the gas tank. Rosenthal opened the driver's side door and leapt out only seconds before the fire ignited by the bomb reached the ruptured gas tank,
thus engulfing the entire vehicle in flames.
Rosenthal suffered burns to his legs and face from the blast. He was transported to Sunrise Hospital and released after only a few hours. Two U.S. Secret Service agents, who were in the parking lot scouting the area in preparation for a fundraising visit by U.S. President Ronald Reagan, were also injured by flying glass. Intelligence unit detectives from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and agents from the local FBI field office immediately directed their suspicions at organized crime figures linked to Chicago, including ruthless mobster Tony "The Ant" Spilotro. Law enforcement saw the murder attempt as an opportunity to recruit a valuable informant to bring down one of the largest organized crime outfits in the country. The head of Metro's intelligence unit even threatened to withdraw police protection from Rosenthal and his young children if he refused to cooperate. This forced Clark County Sheriff John McCarthy to issue a public apology to Rosenthal. Rosenthal, eager to avoid any further attempts on his life, held a press conference intended to reach his former associates where he issued a statement. Of the police efforts to turn him state's witness, Lefty said, "Thanks, but no thanks. That's not my style." Frank Lefty Rosenthal suffered no further attempts on his life, and by all accounts, he did what few mobsters ever managed to do.
He kept most of his ill-gotten gains
and lived to a long age as a free man. From the early days of mob influence in Las Vegas to the more recent acts of violence, all of these incidents have had a significant impact on the fabric of Las Vegas society. And more than anything, they've shown the resilience of the city in the face of tragedy and the courage of its citizens to stand up against threats to their safety and security. To learn more about this Las Vegas true crime story and many others, visit mayheminthedesert.com and get yourself acquainted with the darker side of Sin City's history. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is based on material researched and written by Megan and Anthony Smith and is adapted for podcast, edited, and narrated by Jeff Walker. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is a co-production of Mayhem in the Desert and Walker New Media. Copyright 2024.